Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening. Welcome to a live webinar for National Standard Setters on the eve of the launch of the new IFRS standard on insurance contracts, IFRS 17. This is the second webinar specifically for National Standard Setters. My name is Joanna Yeo. I'm a senior technical manager and have been and is on the insurance project. I am joined today by Steve Cooper, an ISB board member. Steve has been on the board during significant stages of the project that completes with the publication of IFRS 17. We will be answering questions at the end of the presentation. You can submit questions at any time during the presentation using the box on your computer screen that says questions or ask a question. You can also download in PDF format the slides that we are sharing to you today in the event resources section. So today we will be covering, firstly, an outline of the problem with insurance accounting today and why IFRS 17 has been developed. We'll provide a high-level summary of how IFRS 17 works and explain the impact of IFRS 17 for investors. We will also highlight expected changes for life insurers and non-life insurers going forward. So firstly, why has IFRS 17 been developed? We have an existing IFRS 4 on insurance contracts. IFRS 4 is an interim standard. It allows entities to continue to apply accounting policies and practices that existed prior to when entities adopted international financial reporting standards. Many of those accounting policies result in a lack of useful information and hinders understanding of how an entity is performing. For example, many of those accounting policies use assumptions that existed when the contract is issued and is not subsequently updated. Options and guarantees are not fully reflected in the measurement of the insurance contracts. Very often, these options and guarantees are valuable. Most practices also tend to use an asset-based discount rate, normally the expected return on assets, and this does not reflect the economics of most insurance contracts because those insurance liabilities do not promise any asset returns. The existing accounting policies also result in a lack of transparency about profitability. It is often very hard to understand how profit is earned from an insurance contract. Over this time period today, there are a variety of practices about when an entity recognizes profits from an insurance contract. I have seen practices where all the profits are recognized immediately when the contract is written, or all of it only immediately when the contract is derecognized. I've also seen that the profits are recognized over the coverage period, but sometimes the profits from the contract can extend to coverage periods beyond that. So it could go beyond when the contract is already existing. So it will go beyond after the contract is derecognized. There is also a lack of transparency on how an insurance business is making profits. Typically, insurers today earn profits from three sources. One, from providing insurance coverage. Two, from investments, by investing the premiums they have received upfront into assets. And three, from fees, from fee-based type services, for example, asset management services. Today, this is very hard to understand from what they see on the financial statements, and we'll explain a little bit more about that. This is why today there's a variety of non-GAAP measures out there which companies have developed to try to explain financial performance. However, these non-GAAP measures are typically not comparable between companies. This lack of comparability is a multi-level problem. You have, first of all, obviously lack of comparability of insurers between jurisdictions because they're all doing different gaps, but also within the jurisdiction you could have a lack of comparability because within the jurisdiction you could have different requirements being applied for similar contracts. Very often today, insurance accounting follows the entity. So if you're a life insurer, you use life insurance accounting no matter what type of contract you may be issuing, and similar if you're a non-life insurer. Within the consolidated financial statements, very often a user is unable to meaningfully compare what is happening. This is because IFRS 4 provides an exemption to the requirement that preparers are required to have consistent accounting policies for insurance contracts. This means that an insurer which operates in several jurisdictions are often aggregating measurements using different requirements for similar products when presenting consolidated financial statements. And finally, the requirements that are applicable today are very often inconsistent with other industries. The examples we have today here mainly relate to life product, where revenue typically reported in the statement of financial performance includes deposits. And also revenue is typically reported on a cash basis. I will now turn this over to Steve to explain a little bit more about these things.
Okay, thanks Joanna. So I'm going to show you some numbers and show you how IFRS 17 is going to be presented in income statement, balance sheet, and the notes, and give you, I hope, a good flavor of the information that will be available to investors and why we believe it will improve the ability for the investors to understand these insurance contracts and entities that issue those contracts. Before I go into the worked example showing IFRS 17, I thought I'd just share with you a typical income statement. Well, as Joanna said, the existing accounting is quite varied, so perhaps it's quite difficult to claim this as a typical income statement, but it's an example of an existing income statement. And as Joanna said, the top line itself is quite a difficult number because it is not the same as you would expect really for any other industry. In the whole of the rest of IFRS, we don't have a cash-based revenue number, which is typically the case for at least the life insurance industry. And also, we only show on the top line the revenue from the delivery of goods and services. We don't include deposit or investment type receipts in the top line. So the existing income statement starts off with a figure which is quite difficult for investors, I think. Not only that, we also have the returns of deposits as an expense, which seems very odd. And then we have a line item a little lower down the income statement, which is typically called the change in insurance contract liabilities. That change in liability line incorporates several different components, the accretion of a liability because of the time value of money, changes in estimates, the change in the liability reflecting the gross premiums received which have not yet been sort of earned through the provision of services. And while some entities provide an analysis of that line, many don't. And this is one of the key line items, I feel, in life company accounts, which makes it quite difficult for investors to access and really means that it's only specialist investors that typically tackle the analysis of insurance companies. The problems also extend to the balance sheet. We have several different line items typically at the moment: premiums receivable, unearned premiums, insurance contract liabilities, and deferred acquisition costs, all different components of what we're now going to incorporate into essentially a single line item, which is the insurance contract liabilities. So rather than dwelling on the existing accounting, what I want to do is really try and help you give an overview of really what IFRS 17 is all about, and what better way to do that than to go through some of the numbers that will be presented under IFRS 17. Now, this example is derived from the effects analysis. I know you haven't seen that yet, but tomorrow we will publish the effects analysis along with all the other documents to do with IFRS 17. And I think, Joanna, this is in the appendix, the effects analysis. I've slightly modified it in order to fit it on the slides and show some different aspects for the purpose of this presentation. But essentially, the numbers come from that effects analysis. Now, the first thing to note is that the income statement layout that I presented here, or I've summarized it, I agree there will be sort of additional line items giving more disaggregation, but this summary will appear the same whatever type of insurance contract is issued. At the moment, we have quite a different presentation for life and non-life type businesses. This presentation that I'm showing you here will be the same for all the different types of insurance contracts. Now, obviously, the numbers will vary, whether it's short-term, long-term, whether there's significant investment component or not. The balance of the figures will change, but the format will remain the same. Also, notice that the top line is called revenue, and I'll say more about this later, but that revenue line is entirely consistent with the revenue for any other industry. It represents the consideration received for goods and services provided during the period, in this case, the provision of insurance coverage. Notice also there is no line item for change in insurance liability. That really confusing line that appears in life company financial statements isn't necessary under IFRS 17 because of the way in which we've structured the model. Another key feature of this income statement is this source of earnings type analysis. So you'll notice there's a separate subtotal for in the insurance service result and then for the net financial result. At the moment, it can be quite difficult to differentiate between the income that's earned from the provision of insurance coverage, the underwriting result, or the insurance service result, as we've called it, and then what is derived from the investment of the premiums which are received and the spread or the net investment return that is derived from that. In the balance sheet, we are just going to show essentially one line item, insurance contract liabilities, and this will incorporate the various components which are currently often shown separately. Now, there won't be information lost as a result of that because the components of this liability will be shown separately in the notes, and I'll come on to that in a second. Insurance contract liabilities could be in an asset position, not particularly common, but some of them could be, and if they were, then those groups of insurance contracts in an asset position will be shown within assets. There won't be any netting off, which is commonly the case at the moment. I'm not going to talk about reinsurance contract assets today. Reinsurance contracts are within the scope of IFRS 17, and much of the information I'm going to show you for the insurance contract liabilities applies as a kind of a mirror image, not quite a mirror image, but similarly to the liabilities, but just from an asset perspective. Reinsurance contract assets is one of the details that no doubt you will learn about as you learn more about IFRS 17. There are lots of other aspects to it as well. So I want to concentrate on the insurance contract liabilities and how they are presented.
Thank you, Steve. Just a reminder for those listening that you're welcome to submit a question to us at any time during the presentation using the box on your screen called Ask a Question. We will have time, hopefully at the end of the presentation, to answer a few questions on, nobody will know you've asked the question, so the questions will be shared on an anonymous basis. Also, for those listening in, you can get a PDF copy of the slides if you look at the event resources box. Thank you, Steve.
Okay, thanks, Joanna. So, what I'd like to do is to delve into the insurance contract liability. So that figure that appeared on the balance sheet that I showed you of 205,724 for the 2000X1 in this case, and what that means, what it's made up of, how it's derived, and then particularly how it changes from one period to the next and how that links in with the balance, with the cash flow statement and income statement, and what information an investor should be able to derive from that. So the insurance contract liability itself is made up of three components, as you can see here. We used to call this the building block approach, those three components, but we don't use that phrase in the standard, but it's made up of the present value of the expected future cash flows arising from the contract. That would be both cash inflows and outflows, but generally it's going to mean a net cash outflow in respect of that liability. An adjustment for risk, an adjustment that explicitly takes into account the non-financial risk, the insurance risks associated with the contract, and then an unearned profit, the amount of profit that is expected in present value terms over the remaining term of that contract. What I'm going to do is to explain each of those components, because I think it's very important to understand these components of the liability, because it's from there that you can then understand the changes and how it's reflected in the financial statements. So firstly, the future cash flows. The important thing to note here is that these are current estimates. So things are updated. Part of the problem that Joanna mentioned at the moment is that in some jurisdictions, those cash flows aren't current and aren't updated. So they're current estimates. They're also probability weighted, so they're expected cash flows. And for this component of the liability, they are unbiased. So in other words, they're effectively the 50th percentile. They are an unbiased estimate of those future cash flows. Now, sometimes these cash flows can be extremely complex. So where we have options, guarantees, complex features in contracts, there may need to be more complex actuarial methods that are applied. So stochastic modeling, for example, may be necessary in these situations. The cash flows of the contract will include the premiums. They include expenses, which are directly attributable to that contract, and they include, obviously, the claims and benefits that are paid to the policyholder. They also include acquisition costs. As a result of including the acquisition costs in the assessment of the contract cash flows, we no longer have a separate deferred acquisition cost asset. It also means there is consistent accounting for acquisition costs. At the moment, as Joanna said, we have lots of diversity, and that diversity extends to the accounting for acquisition costs. Now, obviously, in order to determine these cash flows, we need to know a contract boundary. I'm not going to go into that here, but a good part of the standard deals with the definition of an insurance contract and the contract boundary in order to determine what those cash flows are. They're current and updated and unbiased. They have to be discounted. The discount rate that is applied to these cash flows is a current market consistent discount rate. So we don't allow historic out-of-date discount rates. They have to be updated. The market consistency is that they mustn't be sort of inconsistent with the information that you receive in the market. Clearly, there'll have to be some estimation in some cases, because observable market rates may only go out to a period which is shorter than the duration of the liability of the insurance contract cash flows. So there'll have to be an element of estimation for some of those, for part of that yield curve. That's no different from any other current value measurement. Joanna said, we don't use the asset return unless it's relevant. So the discount rate for the liability cash flows does not include an asset return premium unless the liability cash flows themselves are linked to those assets, essentially a participating type contract. The discount rate is going to be a key feature in the measurement that appears in the balance sheet, and therefore, as you would expect, there are disclosures about those discount rates. So combining the cash flows with the discounting, you get to the present value of the cash flows, which is a component of the total insurance liability. The second component is the risk adjustment. So this is an explicit compensation that the company requires for bearing insurance risk. At the moment, it's very common to have this adjustment for risk incorporated within the liability without it being visible. So what we're doing is making this risk adjustment explicit and transparent. Now, it is an entity-specific measure. It's not a market participant type approach. It's entity-specific, so there will be a difference between companies depending upon their own perception of risk. But this is why it's so important that it is shown separately with associated disclosures. The risk adjustment would be expected to result in profit in the income statement as the entity is released from risk, because obviously the present value of the cash flows represents the total cash that is expected to be paid, and then this risk adjustment will turn into profit, assuming that those cash flow estimates turn out to be correct. And then lastly, the contractual service margin. So the contractual service margin is that part of the premiums which are received, which are not going to be paid back out in claims and benefits, and which are which is in excess of the risk adjustment that has been ascribed to that contract. So it's effectively a balancing figure on day one. We set this so that there is a zero gain or loss on day one for the contract. There's no day one profit, as Joanna said, is sometimes the case at the moment. But this unearned profit, if you like, this contractual service margin is going to be a key piece of information for the investors. It has some links in with the existing embedded value disclosures. Many of you will be aware that embedded value is a common means of communicating the results of insurance companies. It's effectively a non-GAAP measure. And many of the components of embedded value have effectively been incorporated into IFRS 17 so that we have one comprehensive way of presenting the insurance result, including the value element of it as opposed to simply the accruals accounting component. So the three components, the present value of the cash flows, the risk adjustment, the contractual service margin, combine to make up the total insurance contract liability. And one of the key features of the standard is the requirement to disclose an explanation about how those components of the insurance contract liability change over time. And really, if you understand this disclosure, this note, this liability roll forward, then you really understand IFRS 17. And I would anticipate that this roll forward and all the analysis that will go with it will be a key focus for investors seeking to interpret insurance company financial statements. So what I've shown here is very much in summary form what this roll forward will look like. So at the top, you can see the opening insurance contract liability being the present value of the future cash flows. The fact that that's a positive number indicates that it's a liability in the way I've done it. The risk adjustment, which increases that liability, and then the contractual service margin, which is a further component of the liability, representing the unearned risk-adjusted profit. And then you'll see that there are essentially three sections to this. There are changes which relate to the current insurance service result. These are changes which appear in the top half of the profit and loss account. And then changes in the liability which relate to the insurance finance expense. This is what appears in that second section in the profit and loss account. And then the cash flow changes. Now, obviously, this is somewhat simplified because companies will also have business combinations, exchange differences, and the like, but I'm ignoring those complications. Let me start off by looking at the top section here, and particularly what I've labeled number one, the future service yet to be provided, because this service result is driven by future service, current service, and past service, as you can see. So let's expand that future service yet to be provided section. When insurance entities issue new insurance contracts, let's assume they're profitable to start with. Onerous contracts will deal with separately. But assume the company issues a new profitable insurance contract, you notice that there is no change in the total insurance contract liability. So you'll see a zero in the total column for new profitable contracts recognized. But that doesn't mean to say there isn't very important information here about those new contracts. And what we're showing in this roll forward is the fact that as a result of writing these new contracts, we expect a net cash inflow, the negative figure is inflows, of 2344. So the present value of the premiums we expect for these contracts exceeds the present value of the claims and expenses. So this is the profit that we would expect as a result of writing these new contracts in the period. Now we have a risk adjustment of 969, so this is the compensation we're requiring for the risk coverage, and then the 1375 is the risk-adjusted profit that we expect from this contract. Neither the 969 nor the 1375 appear in the income statement immediately. They are recognized, in the first case, as the entity is released from risk associated with these contracts, and in the second case, the contractual service margin, as the entity provides the coverage and other services associated with that contract. In addition to recognizing new contracts, there's also the possibility that we will have to change estimates for existing contracts. So the next line down shows the estimate changes for existing profitable contracts. Now, when we change estimates, we also don't show an immediate amount in the profit and loss count. This is the so-called unlocking approach that we have applied in the standard. So in this particular case, things have got worse for our existing contracts. So the estimates of the net cash outflows have increased by 1452. So mortality or expense assumptions have changed and we expect to pay out more. Essentially what we do is we adjust the future unearned profit by this change. So we're not saying this results in an immediate loss. We're saying, well, it will reduce the amount of profit that we will allocate to profit and loss in future periods. So again, nothing appears in the income statement immediately. But nevertheless, there is important information shown within this roll forward. Now that 1375 and the 1491 essentially is part of the information that you get at the moment only through the embedded value disclosures if an entity chooses to provide embedded value, because of course it's not part of IFRS 4. Sometimes an insurance entity will issue onerous contracts. Now we wouldn't expect this to be very common, obviously, but if onerous contracts are issued, then new onerous contracts will be shown as an immediate loss. So this is in common with any other industry. IFRS 15, of course, you recognize revenue and profits from revenue contracts over the period over which you deliver the goods and services, but if an entity writes an onerous contract, then IFRS 15 points you to IAS 37, and then you recognize an onerous contract loss. Likewise, if there are estimate changes which result in onerous contracts or which increase or reduce the amount of an onerous contract, then we will also recognize that in profit or loss, just like any other accounting. One of the challenges that we faced in developing the standard was trying to strike a balance between, in terms of the level of aggregation. I'm sure you've heard about the level of aggregation challenges in this standard. Well, essentially, that 123 figure that we've got there and the 94 below it is very much dependent upon that level of aggregation. Some people would have liked us to have effectively netted off the 123 against the 1375 and said, well, overall, contracts issued in this period are net profitable, so why would we want to show an immediate onerous contract loss? The board took the view that it is important that if some contracts have been issued which are loss-making, that those are separately identified and that the loss is immediately recognized, as we would do for any other industry.
I think, Steve, at this time it's good to take one of the questions that have come through. So the questions that come through is the principle of the CSM similar to the principle of revenue recognition that we currently have in IFRS 15? And I think this is This is a very good question, and I think, again, one of the objectives of the project is to increase consistency with other standards. And so recognizing losses immediately when you know, and then recognizing profit over the period where services is earned is consistent with revenue recognition. Also consistent with revenue recognition is that the CSM will be recognized in profit and loss as services as are earned over the coverage period. And the standard will require that this is provided using a coverage units idea, which is the quantum of benefits and the passage of time.
Okay, thanks, Joanna. I also noticed there's a question here saying, Stephen said the 50th percentile, the median, but surely meant the mean. Well, yes, I do mean the mean. And it may not, of course, be the 50th percentile if the distribution isn't symmetric. So yes, you're quite right, but didn't want to get into too much of the statistics in all of this. All right, let's move on to current service. So as Jana was saying, we allocate the contractual service margin over the coverage period, and this is really what drives performance in the P&L for the current period, or the primary driver of performance. So you'll notice that of the contractual service margin which we have at the beginning of the year and which we added in during the year, we are allocating 923 of that to the current year's profit and loss. So, well, this is roughly 10% of the total contractual service margin, so it indicates that, well, roughly the life of the contracts is perhaps 10 years. Now, of course, it won't work exactly like that because we've got to take into account lapses and the rest of it. But the 923 is the amount that ends up in profit and loss for the delivery of services during the period. In addition, there is also the release of the risk adjustment. I said that the risk adjustment also turns into profit as and when we are released from risk. So that 604 is a portion of the total risk adjustment, and that is also then reflected in profit and loss. And these are the key drivers of the current period operating or underwriting performance. There is one other component in the current period, and that's what we call the experience gain or loss. At the beginning of the year, the estimate of the cash flows is just that, an estimate. In the current period, claims paid may be higher or lower than we had previously estimated. In this particular case, the claims paid are more than we had previously thought, and that 35 is then reflected as a loss within the current period. Now, although in the roll forward we will see these three figures as the components of the current period service result, they're actually not presented in exactly that way in the income statement. Instead, we convert those into revenues and expenses, and I'll show you the way that's done later. But the whole point with this is that we are presenting in this roll forward kind of sort of two views of the business. One is the view of how much value has been created by business written in the period. That's on the previous slide. And then on this slide, how much profit has been earned because we have delivered services in the current period. So this is kind of an accruals type view, a view that's consistent with IFRS 15, whereas the previous slide provided information which was much more value-based and reminiscent of embedded value disclosures. And this is why I think this information set from IFRS 17 is going to provide so much more information for investors, information which at the moment is shown partly in the financial statements, partly outside the financial statements, is all going to be combined into one coherent set of information based upon the same underlying measurement principles and then applied consistently across jurisdictions. And then the last component is perhaps the easiest, and that's past service. So once we've recognized claims, once claims have occurred, of course, we end up with an estimate of what the claim payment is going to be. When we actually settle, we may pay slightly more, slightly less. And this obviously depends upon the type of insurance entities, but if you have long tail coverage type business, health business, for example, then you could end up with a significant variation in past estimates. So this is a true up, if you like, that is included. So in this particular case, I think there's a loss of 40 that ends up in the current period profit and loss. So the changes which in the liability which relate to the underwriting result analyzed into future, current, and past, and this transparency by showing the changes in the liability, I think is going to transform the way in which investors are going to be able to interpret these figures. Moving on to the next section in the roll forward, which is the insurance finance expenses. This is essentially the unwinding of the discount that applies to the liability. So the liability is a present value. That present value will increase over time simply because of the passage of time. The unwind of that discounting is the insurance finance expense. Well, actually, it's a little bit more than that because there, of course, can be changes in assumptions. So in addition to the unwind, if the discount rates change, or indeed other financial assumptions change, then that will also affect the liability and will be reflected in this insurance finance expense. In this particular example, we've shown the whole of the insurance finance expense in profit or loss. But as I'm sure many of you are aware, we also provide an option to put some of this insurance finance expense in OCI. When the OCI option is taken, essentially the accretion at the historical locked-in discount rate, the discount rate at inception of the contract, applies in profit or loss, and then the assumption changes will be reflected in OCI. Now, it's not quite as simple as that because it does depend upon the nature of the contract, whether it's participating or not, and whether the variable fee, the direct participation features apply or not. But essentially, it is sort of an allocation that appears in P&L and then the movement and the volatility and the changes in assumptions which appear in OCI. But as I say, this is an option. It's an option that can be applied by portfolio, and it is a free choice that entities have. We don't generally like giving free choices in accounting standards. Investors constantly tell us that it's a bad idea. But this was one of the compromises that were made in developing the standard, and it is an entire free choice for each entity to apply. And then the last component of the roll forward is the cash flows. And there's a lot of information here as well. So, for example, the premiums received during the period. Remember I said that at the moment, premiums received are often shown as the top line in the income statement of a life business. Well, we're no longer showing it in the P&L. Instead, we're going to show premiums on an earned basis. But the premiums received amount is still available to investors. Many investors will like to see this number because it's an important measure of volume. The premiums received are a component of the roll forward. Then the claims, the payment of claims and benefits, the insurance acquisition cash flows complete the reconciliation of the opening to the closing liability. So that shows how the liability is derived, the cash flows, the risk adjustment, and the unearned profit, the CSM, and then how changes in those items are then reflected in the primary financial statements and the associated sort of disclosures about new business that goes with it. As I said, this, I think, is going to increase the richness of the information provided to investors. The same presentation will apply to all insurance contracts, so whether it's life, non-life, short-term, long-term. However, there is a simplified approach available for short-term contracts, essentially the short-term P&C contracts, which is the premium allocation approach. The premium allocation approach is consistent with what I've said, except you just get less detail. You essentially don't get the analysis of the liability into the cash flows, risk adjustment, and the CSM components. But I wasn't going to go into the detail of the simplified approach today. Now, you mentioned that when I talked about the release of the CSM and the risk adjustment, that I said that they're not actually presented in that way in the income statement. If you recall, when I showed you the income statement, there was revenue and expenses. Well, the following couple of slides show how this insurance service result is presented. And as I said, we present insurance revenue less insurance expenses, and the total of those two equals the release of the CSM, the risk adjustment, and then the experience adjustments. Now, to illustrate this, we have to split the insurance liability slightly differently into a liability for remaining coverage and a liability for incurred claims. This is an approach which will be very familiar to anybody that looks at the non-par type insurance business, the P&C type insurance business, because this is a very common way of presentation in that case. Before I show you the roll forward itself, let me explain a little bit about insurance contract revenue. The premiums received, let's assume that it's a single premium contract, 5-year coverage period. The premiums received on day one represent the liability for remaining coverage. So once you've got those premiums, then all you've got is future cash going out, plus the risk adjustment and the CSM. That total liability for remaining coverage then declines over time as and when, firstly, you repay any deposit component, and then secondly, as you recognize insurance contract revenue. You'll notice that the insurance contract revenue in this case is actually less than the initial premium received. That's because part of the premiums are returned to investors in the form of investment components, return of deposits. Had those deposits been zero, which would be the case, say, for a coverage type contract, then actually the insurance contract revenue would have been greater than the premiums received due to the time value of money because of the accretion, just the same as in IFRS 15. When there are significant investment components, the insurance revenue will be less than the premiums. But that reflects the fact that only part of the premium is a payment for services provided over the coverage period. That reduction in the that recognition of revenue is reflected in this alternative roll forward. Now, I'm not going to go through this one in the same detail as I did last time, but you'll notice that on the left-hand side, there is a liability for remaining coverage. On the right, the liability for incurred claims. And the total column is the same totals as we had before. But it's simply analyzing it into what we would call perhaps unearned premiums in the past, and then a claims liability, the liability for incurred claims that we've got here. What happens is that when premiums are received, they increase the liability for remaining coverage. So you notice down the bottom in the cash flow section, there's a premiums received of 33,570. But then as services are provided, those premiums then end up in profit and loss as insurance contract revenue, in this case, 9,856. But some of the liability for remaining coverage disappears because of investment components, and that's the 6,465, which doesn't affect profit or loss, effectively becomes a balance sheet movement with the cash payment. The liability for incurred claims goes up as claims and expenses are incurred in the period and then become settled. So the 7,985 is the claims in the period, and then the settlement of those claims plus the payment of the deposit components is the 14,336 lower. Now, this company is obviously a life business. It has a very small liability for incurred claims and a very large liability for remaining coverage, and it has a significant investment component. So this is not a sort of typical P&C business. But these roll forwards will apply whatever type of business is written. It's just that the balance of the numbers will vary. Now, you also notice there's a column in here for onerous contract components. So there's transparent information about onerous contracts that have arisen and the changes that arise during the period. Okay, well, I realize that what I've done in going through these numbers has been quite challenging. I hope it's given you a good picture of the sort of information that's going to be presented in IFRS 17. Obviously, how the individual numbers are calculated is a large part of what IFRS 17 is all about. So how you work out the discount rate, what are the cash flows, the contract boundary, how you work out what goes into OCI. I think IFRS 17 is going to bring significant benefits particularly to investors in these insurance entities. Global comparability, we certainly don't have that at the moment. Relevant and updated measurement of liabilities, as Joanna said, many liabilities at present are out of date. They don't reflect, for example, the time value of options and guarantees. Financial risk and economic mismatches are revealed. That net financial result is going to be a very important piece of information for investors and give more transparency to those financial risks. The source of earnings approach, which so many investors really find informative. Value of new business, so that the embedded value type information is integrated with the accounting and measured consistently with it. This, I think, is a big, big improvement compared with existing accounting. Enhanced disclosure and greater transparency. And I think, although it looks complex, I think you will find that once you get into this, it is a very intuitive system, and it will make the whole insurance industry much, much more understandable once people get used to it.
Okay, thank you, Steve. As we promised a little bit of at the start of the presentation, a little bit on the non-life contracts, I just want to just highlight a few things about the short-term contracts, and then we'll move on to the questions that we're going to take. I guess the first thing to say is to say what happens typically is the gaps are structured according to entities. So if you have a property and casualty license or a non-life insurance license, your requirements tend to follow your license that you hold in a particular jurisdiction. This won't be the case going forward. There is a simplified approach in the requirements of IFRS 17, and those requirements are very similar to application of the unearned premium approach that many entities do today. However, contracts will have to be eligible to apply this simplified approach. So if you have a coverage period of less than 1 year, it's automatic that you can apply, but some property and casualty contracts last much longer than 1 year, so they would need to consider that. There's a key differences with the simplified approach that I just mentioned briefly to the general model that Steve has been talking about for a while, which is for the pre-claims liability, what we call the liability for remaining coverage. You do not need to measure the cash flow separately from the risk adjustment, separately from the contractual service margin. So it is very similar to the unearned profit model that's used today. The main difference will be for the claims liability, or what the standard will call the liability for incurred claims. That claims liability will be discounted using a discount rate that reflects the characteristics of that liability, and then entities will need to apply your risk adjustment. There is a simplification provided in the standard that if the settlement is expected to be 1 year or less, that entity needs not discount the incurred claims liability. So for many life businesses, IFRS 17 is not expected to produce a fundamental change. However, one thing is noted that even though many of the non-life contracts applied to today look similar in application, IFRS 17 will bring consistency because there are differences in how people use that particular model. So now we have a few minutes to get into the questions. You have been sending along the questions, which have been very helpful. But I thought I'll start with one first. So, Steve.
So we've got a question. What is the effective date of this standard? Well, it's 2021. So there's 3.5 years before applying the standard, but it is 2021 with restatement of comparatives. So the 2020 comparatives will have to be restated. We have another question about expenses. Are the expenses that are allocated to each contract those that can be directly attributed to that specific contract, or can there be expenses which are notionally allocated to each contract based on a unit cost type approach? Well, firstly, the expenses are determined at a portfolio level, so they're not individual contract expenses. Therefore, there would have to be an element of allocation, so contract acquisition costs and the service sort of servicing type expenses that are applied. So there will be an allocation. Exactly what method you use to do that allocation, well, the standard doesn't go into the detail. Obviously, that's the way in which it is applied, and I'm sure different people will do different things, but the objective of expense allocation is very clear within the standard itself. And then another one about onerous contracts. Somebody's asking, I'm wondering at what level they are measured. Now, you're right that the level at which they're measured is key. The unit of aggregation, we call it, and this person says, do we measure at the contract level or portfolio level? Well, I don't think we've got time here to go through the detail of this, but it is at a group of contracts level, and we have quite detailed explanations about how to do it at initial recognition and then how to do it subsequently. This is one of the challenging areas in developing the standard, in trying to strike a balance between operationality, because the lower the level of aggregation, the more costly it is to sort of process the information, but also providing relevant information to investors. And we didn't want to go to too high a level of aggregation and then all this information is lost. Level of aggregation also affects the allocation of the CSM, so that was another factor that we took into account in that determination. Joe, you've got any you want to answer?
Well, one question here is, a question that's come in is, why is IFRS 17 different from the regulatory accounting that's applied today? So perhaps for in Europe they have Solvency II. Why is it different?
Go ahead.
I guess one thing that you need to bear in mind is that solvency requirements are often set to for financial stability reasons, whereas for IFRS 17, the main objective is financial performance and financial position. So very, very much going forward, the board concentrated on what would be the best way of reflecting the insurance business in the statements of profit and loss and in the statements of financial position. But very often going forward, I think we would expect companies to build on their solvency requirements. So very often they could maybe they could leverage off some of the systems they have used for solvency requirements. But again, the objectives are already set.
Okay, another one. And early application, question mark. So yes, you can apply the standard early. The effective date is 21, but you can apply early. Somebody else saying, calculating these figures for the back book is going to be complex. So this is a reference to transition. Now, we do require retrospective application. So in order to make the information useful, we generally require and we would expect people to restate their financial statements entirely onto the new basis. However, we recognize that that is going to be complex. And as a result, we have a number of practical expedients and simplifications to help that transition. Now, in the case of IFRS 17, is actually helped a lot by the current measurement of the cash flows and the risk adjustment, because you don't need to go back at all in order to determine what the current position is. But determining the unearned profit, the CSM, is more complex. And the transition reliefs essentially focus upon that CSM. So the second part of the question, did you consider allowing the back book to be accounted for as currently the case? Well, yes, we did, but we decided not to, because we believe that having half of your business on the old IFRS 4 and half on IFRS 17 wasn't really going to provide good information to investors.
Now, one question that's come up was, did we do any testing with companies on these proposals? And there were four rounds of field testing over the life of the project, which are available on the website, a summary of what the testing that was conducted, and a summary of those results, which are all publicly available, are available on our WEN website. Now, how will this standard affect companies who provide insurance such as car and mobile, etc. I guess the question is perhaps on, you know, perhaps when you go and buy a car, sometimes you're offered car insurance at the same time. And it's a question of whether the car seller is acting as an agent. So basically, you know, there's an insurer that actually they're just selling it on behalf of the insurer, or whether actually that car seller is also an insurer. Obviously, if you're acting as an agent, meaning you're just selling insurance for the insurer when at the same time you're selling the car, This standard doesn't apply to you. That's a revenue recognition question. You're acting as an agent. However, if you're a car seller that also engages in insurance, then you are within the scope of this standard. I think this is a good point to note that the standard is for insurance contracts and not for insurance entities. At the same time, it should be noted that there are a few scope exceptions in the standard. Firstly, there is IFRS 17 carries forward the current option for financial guarantee contracts that is currently in IFRS 4. So for financial guarantee contracts, these contracts could be accounted for either under IFRS 9 or IFRS 17, depending on what your previous accounting used to be for these contracts. And there are also contracts called fixed fee service contracts. A good example, perhaps, is car breakdown services. And so there's an option as well. Now, I'm getting very aware that we're getting very close to the time. Is there a particular question, Steve, that you want to answer before the last question before we
I don't think we can, Jo.
Okay.
We have our board meeting starting in 5 minutes.
Oh, yes,
time,
that's so right, Steve. You have to.
Even though there are some other
very, very good questions. We will be repeating this presentation in the afternoon, so we'll be repeating it live again, and we'll be taking questions live again then, and perhaps some of these questions here, if there's no questions in the afternoon session, we'll bring it to the afternoon session. You're more than welcome again to log in also to the afternoon session. I will end by saying thank you very much for listening to this webinar. There will be an upload of the presentation onto our website tomorrow, hopefully. And thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for listening. Goodbye.